Welcome to the Lesbian Book Club with Claire Lydon. Please enjoy the podcast from My Lesbian Radio.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of the Lesbian Book Club with me, your host, Claire Lydon. This month, we've got a fabulous interview with US author Kate Christie, and you'll hear that fantastic jamboree that we had in a few moments. But before we get to that, we're going to see what's hot in the UK and US Amazon lesbian fiction charts, as usual, as well as filling you in on what I've been up to over the last month or so, including the release of my brand new audiobook, Nothing to Lose. Hurrah! So first up, the Amazon charts and Top of the Pops in the US and the UK, as I record this on September the 2nd, is J.A. Armstrong with book 9 in her By Design series called Campaign Trail. Now we're back with Candice and Jameson. I've mentioned Jameson before, a bit of a whiskey name there. This time round, Candice has decided for her sins to run for the US presidency. But there are some shady goings-on to sort out, including a serial killer on the loose, which I'm sure is just about the only thing Hillary didn't have to sort out in real life. But the Candice, it's going to be all part of the circus that is running for the US presidency. But that should be really cool. Those are really, really popular books, as noticed by the fact that she just released it and it's number one in the US and the UK and it's book 9, so those are very popular. Also running up the charts this week is another former podcast guest, Eliza Lenski, who's just released book 5 in her Winter Jacket series, and this one's called Hunter. Now this one is a prequel to the Winter Jacket books, and it's got a brilliant blurb, I have to say. Blurbs are really difficult to write. Blurbs are the descriptions of your book. And I think I speak for many writers in saying that I'd rather write, you know, I can write a 70,000 word book, but try and distill it into 250 words. And it's very, very difficult without making it blah. But this blurb for Hunter is brilliant. So go and read it. It's short, it's sexy, it's to the point. Read it and try not to buy it. That you might fail. And just talking about Eliza Lenski, I recently read Don't Call Me Hero, and I thought it was one of the best books I've read, best lesbian books I've read in quite a while. I really, really loved it. So if you haven't read her Don't Call Me Hero, do that. And I haven't read any of the Winter Jacket books, but this one looks like it might be worth a look too. Also doing well in the charts are Emma Nichols' duo of books, Finding You and Remember Me. Now, I'm just playing through these at the moment, as Emma is going to be on the podcast as next month's guests. And I'm just reading Finding You at the moment, book one. I'm really enjoying it, not least because of the amount of food and drink that the lead characters consume. Honestly, I feel full and drunk just reading it. There's so much whiskey and fine wine and very lovely Italian food going on. So I'm hungry. And I'm full, and I'm drunk, and I want to drink. So all those things. Well done, Emma. But I'm looking forward to speaking to her about that next month, because she's had an amazing couple of months with these first books out. In the US, there are another trio of books cluttering up the rest of the top five. First up, Bridget Essex's Cry Wolf has an ultra-pouty woman on the front and is the story of a small town filled with beautiful women and no shortage of werewolves. Now, I've never read a werewolf book. It's not really my thing, but there might be a first time for everything. You never know. This one's doing really well, and Bridget Essex, I know, is a very popular author. Although I did check I got a new Kindle Paperwhite recently, so I don't disturb my wife when I'm reading in bed, which she's very happy about because it's got the backlight now. I had like an old-fashioned Kindle with the keyboard, which I was always fine with, but I've got the Paperwhite now, so that's really cool. But I organise my books into collections, so it's great for OCD people like me. And I realise that I've got over 70 books on my Kindle that I haven't read. So I think I've got to stop buying books and read the ones I've got. But anyway, Yes, Bridget Essex, Cry Wolf. Also doing well in the US is Elle Spencer with her book Forget Me Not, a debut novella about art dealer Sam, who's got no time for men, but might make time for a woman called Mia. This one's got 66 reviews in a month, which is some going, so it could be worth checking out. And finally, Robin Alexander's latest is called Fearless and is about two women, Fallon and Haley. Fallon sounds like a gladiator to me. Fallon and Haley are thrown together on a cruise, and they're both enduring a series of disasters until they meet each other. Can things turn around? I'm guessing the answer is yes, but I'm also guessing there'll be a barrel of laughs along the way because Robin Alexander is the queen of romantic comedy. Yes, she is. I know I've been called that by Sheena at the Lesbian Review. Hi, Sheena, if you're listening. But I think Robin Alexander deserves the crown. All right, so that's the chart roundup, and welcome to September 2017. It's Christmas shopping klaxon alert. Only 110 days left till Christmas. Quick, run out and start your shopping now. I can't quite believe that it's September already. This year has really flown by. But I love September. I love the weather in September. It's my birthday month, so hooray. Hooray for all the Virgos out there. But September, yeah, it's month nine. So we've only got another 4 months till the end of the year. So let's get cracking and squeeze the most we can out of the rest of the year. So is there any other news that's happened over the summer month of August, which I have to say has been very sleepy? It's been a very sleepy August. All the LesFit conferences are done for the year, but we do have a new kid on the block. So that is the announcement for this month, is the Diva Literary Festival has launched its programme at the end of August. The inaugural festival is taking place in Birmingham on November the 3rd to the 5th. So that's in the middle of the UK. So if you're in the UK, I'd say it's worth grabbing a ticket and coming along to the Saturday or the Sunday or both days. I'm speaking on two panels on Sunday the 5th, one on self-publishing and the other on lesbian romance. So if you'd like to come along and hear me warble on about either of those two subjects, get your tickets now and I will see you there. Do come up and say hello. It'd be lovely to meet you. But of course, I'm not really the draw. I'm just one of a load of authors going along. And there are actually a ton of authors I'm really looking forward to seeing. The headliners are Val McDermott, Mari Hanna, and Stella Duffy. But there's a ton of authors. Have a look. It's if you put Diva Literary Festival into Google, it will come up. The programme's been announced, so you can see what's going on. I'll be sharing a stage with the wonderful Kiki Archer, Claire Ashton, Carrie Hunter, Jackie Lawrence and Sally Edwards. So please come along and feel free to shout and heckle. Books, women, Birmingham. What more do you want in one weekend? In personal news, I've just sent my latest book to my editor, so I hope to have that out within the next few weeks, certainly by the end of October it will be out. It's called Twice in a Lifetime. And it is second chance romance. And this one is set in Chicago and New York. So it's my first book I've done set outside of the UK. And I've really loved writing this one. I did it over the last couple of weeks in July and the first 3 weeks in August. I've rattled through it. It's come out pretty quickly and I think well. So I'm excited for you all to read it. I really love it. And as well, as I said in the beginning, other exciting news to share is that my audiobook of Nothing to Lose is finally out and it's had a great reception. It came out finally on August the 4th, hooray. And it's doing really well, which I'm thrilled about. It's hit the bestseller lists in the LGBT categories on Audible in the UK and the US. So I really couldn't be more thrilled and it's getting some fabulous reviews. So thank you so much if you supported this release. It was a big step for me. It's a lot of money to do an audiobook. But it's a big step sort of finding the right narrator and putting it out there. It's like starting publishing all over again. But I'm really thrilled with the job that my narrator, Gabrielle Baker, has done. So thank you to her. And if you downloaded it and listened to it, thank you so much. And if you haven't reviewed it, please do. I'm really grateful for all the reviews that come in. Also, I still do have some free codes to download the book in the UK or the US. So if you'd like one, if you'd like a free review code, please mail me at mail@clairelydon.co.uk. I'll put that address in the show notes. As I say, I'm really thrilled with how it's gone and I am considering doing another one now, maybe for London Calling, the next one. Anyway, that's all from me for this month. Now it's time for the interview with the lovely Kate Christie. I hope you enjoy. So joining me today is US author Kate Christie, who's written a fair few books, including In the Company of Women, Gay Pride and Prejudice, as well as the Girls of Summer series, which focuses on the beautiful game we call football. Kate lives near Seattle with her wife and three children and the family dog. So welcome, Kate.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And I know it's quite early in the morning for you. Well, 10 o'clock, 6 o'clock here. So you've already been up and taken your kids swimming. So you're primed and ready to go, right?
Absolutely. Ready to go. I've got my cup of green tea in hand and I'm ready.
Oh, green tea, not coffee.
No. My wife is a coffee person and I'm a tea person. So we have that sort of difference that we jokingly debate all the time, which is better.
I drink both, so I'm just I'm an anomaly, aren't I?
Ah, so you're a fence sitter.
I am, yeah. I always have tea first though, and then coffee, so I don't know what that says, but you know. So paint a picture of where you're speaking to us from today. Where are you? What room are you in? What can you see?
Yeah, I'm sitting at my dining room table, and I can see out our window to the deck that my dad and I just demolished yesterday. It's just the frame right now. It's waiting for its new boards to go on, so that's in the next day or two. Uh-huh. Beyond that, we have, we're kind of in the forest, in the woods, in western Washington, in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains, and I can see 150-foot fir and cedar trees around the neighbors' homes. So that's kind of what we look out on.
Right. Well, that's pretty cool. That must be quite inspirational every day.
It's gorgeous. And my studio, where I write, sits in the backyard and looks out on kind of the same view. And it, especially in the evening when the light filters through our forest, it's gorgeous. We've got 15 acres out the front of our house that's a green belt that no one can put on.
Oh, cool.
And so it's not our property, but we always call it our forest.
Yeah, why not?
So it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous setting.
Yeah, and a lovely place to sit and write, I'm sure.
Yeah, and very quiet and peaceful.
Yeah. So tell me a bit about your writing journey and how you got started.
Yeah, sure. So I started writing as a kid. I remember in fifth grade we had to do a short story, and mine, because I tend to be verbose, as my wife would say, I ended up writing a collection of short stories, and they were about the character that I called the Dogged Crusader. And of course it was a dog, and I thought I was so clever. And she was this clumsy crime fighter. And I think my early influences were like, did you ever see Get Smart?
I didn't, no.
Okay. Get Smart, Inspector Gadget, and like Scooby-Doo. They were all the kind of kids shows about crime fighting.
I know the other two.
Yeah. Yep. And someone was always clumsy and like accidentally saving the world. And so that's kind of how I had the dog. You know, she would like go after a criminal and slip on a skateboard, because of course what dog doesn't ride a skateboard? And accidentally crash into the criminal and take them down. And so that was kind of how I started writing. And then when I was 13, we drove from Michigan all the way to Alaska through Canada. So we crossed the entire continent and then took a ferry up to Alaska. And the reason that's important for my writing journey is that my sister, we could only bring, this was well before the days of tablets, so we could only pack a small number of books in the car. It was an escort wagon, which is a quite small car.
Yeah.
We towed a camper out the back. And so my sister brought along some Harlequins. She was older. And I ran out of books to read, and she handed me one of her Harlequins. And I was like, romance is cool. This is awesome. So even though it was straight romance, I was like, this is really fun. So I kind of got hooked on romances. And it was almost like an addiction at that point. Mm-hmm. And then as an adult, I kind of came back to romance writing. I came out when I was 18 and college, and kind of put writing aside for a few years while I was in college and explored history and some other subjects, women's studies, feminist history, politics. And then after college, I kind of came back to writing and thought, okay, so I like romances, I want to write lesbian romances, and I kind of see it as sort of an overtly political act to write about two women in love and having a happy ending, because when I graduated from college in the early 90s, you know, the Well of Loneliness was still kind of being, I had a lesbian literature class, and it was held up as, like, the classic of all time, you know, and it's this, this woman who is totally miserable, and I, yeah. Does she die in the end? I can't remember.
I can't, yeah, I've read it, but I can't remember. I just remember feeling like, oh my God, is this the future?
Right. I know. And so everyone else who was writing, you know, Sarah Arna Jewett and Willa Cather, and even, well, I guess Virginia Woolf to some degree, mm-hmm. Everyone was closeted. You know, they were, like, Maya Antonia is this beautiful not lesbian novel as far as I'm concerned. but she wrote it from the perspective, Willa Cather wrote it from the perspective of a man. Mm-hmm. And Sarah Arna Jewett, who was before Willa Cather and was kind of her mentor, was very similar. Mm-hmm. And these are American writers, so I'm not sure if they had as much play in UK.
I'm just impressed you had a lesbian literature class, because that was not on offer anywhere I went to university.
Yeah, no, so queer studies was just starting when I was in college in the early 90s.
Right.
And I was lucky enough, I went to a women's college, so we had lots of things like that, but it's funny because the lesbian literature class that I took was offered at Amherst College, which was nearby, and there was this thing called the Five College Exchange. And Amherst was all men until the early 70s, I think. So it was funny to me that lesbian literature was being offered at this, like, bastion of male privilege.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
And here I am coming from the women's college, and they didn't have it.
Yeah. So cool. Go on, carry on.
Oh, no. So that was definitely cool to take
yeah.
it.
Yeah, definitely. No, yeah, that sounds amazing. I don't know how many are offered even today. I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked into it, but you don't hear about it very often.
Yeah, no, I did my master's and there was nothing about queer people of any kind. Until there was like a 200 level class that I was a TA for, and it was taught by a lesbian, and it was mostly straight kids, and it was really interesting though to kind of be involved in the teaching end of that.
Yeah. So, but you did go on and you did write, you've written quite a few books now. And I read Training Ground and Game Time for this interview, the first two books of the Girls of Summer series. So I feel like I know the leads, Emma and Jamie, pretty well now. And the book's focused on football and the two leads play it to a high level, to national team level. So tell me a bit about writing this series and how it came about. I assume you're a fan of football because there's quite a lot of detail in the books.
I am. I started playing when I was four. And I played Division III NCAA in college, which is to say, I didn't have a scholarship.
Okay.
Yeah. So like I wasn't good enough to. Well, I don't know. Who knows? But I wasn't recruited. It was the early 90s. They didn't have a lot of scholarships for women at the time.
Yeah, I imagine the infrastructure wasn't really there around the game then, was it?
Exactly. There was no pro league. The women hadn't won the World Cup yet. The U.S. women. I think it had been first or second World Cup at that point in 91. I can't even remember if it's the first or second. But anyway, it was just kind of getting going. And so I played in college, and I actually met my wife. She was a sophomore when I was a senior on the team at Smith. I kind of say, without soccer, I wouldn't have the life I have right now. And that's because Chris and I, my wife and I, met playing soccer, and then we kind of both went our separate, we were just friends in college, we just went our separate ways, we kind of stayed in contact through the soccer grapevine, all of our friends were soccer players from college, we each dated a soccer player from our college, and then, I guess like 7 or 8 years after, no, yeah, 7 years after college, she needed an assistant, and she became a Division III college coach, she got her master's in coaching and sports and something around exercise studies, and became a college coach, and that was her job, and I wanted to take some time off of work, and we were friends, and she needed an assistant, and I was like, oh, you live near my sister, I'll come to California and be your assistant, and that'll be great, I'll take some time off, I'll write full time, you know, coaching was only a couple hours a day, and so we agreed on that, and then she took a new job in Massachusetts at Mount Holyoke College, which was near where we had gone to college in western Massachusetts. And so I ended up moving cross-country with her to be her assistant. and we fell in love, and the rest is history.
All right. So, okay. So really, soccer has played an integral part in your life.
Absolutely. It is so, yes.
And I can't believe I just called it soccer. That's sacrilegious.
Sorry. football.
Yeah, yeah, football. So tell me about writing this series then, and I guess what it meant to you, because it must have meant quite a lot.
Yeah, so I think I'd always said to myself, one day I'm going to write a novel about the U.S. women's national team, because, you know, write what you love. And I've always loved following the national team. I'm not a big fan of real person fiction, RPF, in terms of fan fiction. So for me, it was really important to create characters who aren't people, real people from the national team.
Yeah.
So just let me say that right up front. They're composite characters. Some of them will have external characteristics that appear to be like, oh, that one looks like that person, or, you know, that one's that person, but none of them are based on real people.
Okay.
That's kind of how I create characters, is composite. I usually start with a nugget of me and or someone I'm very close to, and then just layer on different kind of characteristics from people I've known, people from television, movies, just, you know, that's how I create characters.
Right.
And so in 2015, the World Cup was held in Canada, Women's World Cup, and the final was in Vancouver. And so my wife and my best friend, who I was co-captains with in college, and her wife, all four of us went to college together. They live in Seattle. We live close to Seattle. And we all decided, hey, let's go up to Vancouver in Canada for the finals. And so we were in BC Place on, you know, July, whatever it was, the 8th or something in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
2015 for the finals, July 6th, I guess. And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Just in terms of the atmosphere for sports, the stadium was full of mostly Americans. There were a few Japanese supporters, not a lot, but it was just this. Have you been to a lot of sporting events?
A lot, yeah. I'm a big sports fan, a big football fan.
So you've been to some of the Premier League games?
Yes, yeah. I go to Tottenham regularly. I'm a member there, so yeah.
Oh, okay. The only game I ever saw was Tottenham and Arsenal, which of course is a huge one.
Yeah, not a grudge match at all.
Yeah.
My wife's an Arsenal fan, so that we have some.
No.
Yeah.
How does that work?
I know, that's what everyone asks us. And we got married the day that Arsenal won the FA Cup. So I was, I can't say I was secretly hoping they'd lose. I wanted a happy wife, but it was a bittersweet victory. Sorry, go on.
No, it's my wife and I are American football fans as well. And she's a Minnesota Viking fan and I'm a Chicago Bear fan. And they're in the same division. And it's very, very contentious.
Right, so, okay.
Yeah. But anyway, so we went to the World Cup final, and it was... when I went and saw Tottenham versus Arsenal, and it was like Boxing Day in 1994, and I went with my... It was at Arsenal Stadium, the old stadium, and I went with my landlord, and he was this huge, like, 6'3" guy, and his brothers, they were all above 6 feet tall, and their son, their oldest son, was like 12, but he was already like, you know, 5'10". Nah, probably not that. Maybe closer to 5.5 feet. And I tell you that because at the end, Arsenal, I guess it was a tie, but the fans were really upset that it was a tie.
Mm-hmm.
And the landlord had to pick me. I'm 5'2". He had to pick me up with his brother by the elbows and get me out because it was so just dangerous. Like, so people were so angry.
Yeah.
And I might have been trampled. And so I kind of contrast that with the Women's World Cup, which was mostly families.
Mm-hmm.
I went down to the sidelines. We got there really early. I went down to the sidelines and took pictures, and the signs that men were holding were things like, I wish I could play like a girl. It was like this positive pro-female atmosphere as well as pro-sports. And I had never really experienced that at a professional sporting event before. That much. There were 55,000 people there, and it was all just love and happiness, which is so weird for sports.
It is. Yeah. I experienced that as well recently. Well, in the Olympics, I saw the UK women play Brazil, and that was 70,000 people in Wembley Stadium.
Oh my gosh.
And we beat Brazil.
Yeah.
I mean, amazing.
Yeah.
And it was,
totally.
And everybody was so, yeah, like you say, so positive. And just this year, we went to see the Women's FA Cup final, which was held at Wembley.
Okay.
And that was 40,000 people, which, you know, is a big crowd, considering, you know, the Premier League games get up like about, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 a game.
Right, and it's relatively new, right? Was that the first?
It was, I think it's the third year that it's been played at Wembley. And I'm not sure how many years the Women's FA Cup has been going. But I mean, that was amazing. And that was such a positive event as well. And afterwards, we went into the bar and we were dancing with the Man City team, the winning team.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, that wouldn't happen. So anyway, yeah. So no, yeah, I do agree. It's an amazing time to be, to witness the changes, in women's sport particularly, which is great.
Well, and especially in the UK for football, because it has been, you know, just looked down upon for so long. And it seems like the World Cup in 2015 really brought the nation in the UK along in terms of support for your team.
It's true, yeah. And the European Championships have just started yesterday, and they're on Channel 4, which is a major network TV station. So that's huge as well. Because that's the first.
There's this kind of idea in women's sports. If you show it, they will come.
Yeah.
but until you put them on television, you're going to get nothing. Until you have advertisers supporting them, no one's going to see them play, and people will approach it with this standard stereotyped view of, you know, women athletes as subpar, which, you know, I mean, and one of the issues that I touch on in, I think, book two is talking about the differences in physiology and biology between men and women. Of course, women are always going to be slower. They're always going to play a different style, but that doesn't mean that it's not an exciting, wonderful game to watch.
No, absolutely.
And hopefully that's changing.
Definitely, and I think that does come over in your books as well, because, I mean, even you spoke about the issue with the artificial pitches, which was in the Canada World Cup, which I was outraged about, but there you go. And clearly you were too.
Yeah, pretty much so. Wait, hold on one second. My phone keeps ringing. Hold on. Sorry about that. It's we get these not crank calls, but, like, companies calling, and then they call back.
Yeah, no, that's all right. No problem. Yeah. So as I said, you deal with a lot of real life issues in the book. So that was really cool to see that. And book one deals with a lot of YA themes, like coming out, finding your identity, getting over trauma as well. And you really got into the heads of these characters as teenagers. So how easy was that to do for you, going back to your youth?
You know, when you say it like that, I think, wow, that must have been hard. But when I think back to writing the book, I came out of the World Cup thinking, okay, I'm ready to write this book I've always wanted to write about the U.S. women's national team. And I sat down and I started plotting it, and I realized I wanted to go back and tell the story from when they were kids, you know, teenagers, and have this kind of first meeting and this first friendship. And to explore these different issues, one person losing a parent and the other one, you know, recovering from trauma, sexual assault trauma. And these were issues that were near and dear to me. My first girlfriend's father died 6 months before we met, and it was a plane crash. And so that was something that she and I were together for a year, and that was a big part of our relationship, was her processing and coming to terms with that. So that had left a big impact on me. And then I'm actually a survivor of childhood sexual assault myself, so that was something I really enjoyed kind of going through. Rewind that sentence. I didn't enjoy experiencing the assault.
No, I understand what you mean.
About the writing process.
Yeah.
Was not only was it kind of closure for me, but it was also, I approached it as this way of, you know, the It Gets Better project for queer youth in America.
Yeah.
And so I approached it kind of as a, it gets better for survivors of sexual trauma, of eventually, you know, not everyone, it doesn't get better for everyone, but for, you know, most people, we learn how to make it as part of our past and how to kind of go on with life, and it gets better, and you can have these wonderful relationships, and you can have children yourself, and kind of, so it was, had a little bit of a political motive, but mostly a personal motive to talk about resilience and strength, and being an athlete for me growing up. I also say that soccer saved me as a teenager, because I was queer, I was gender nonconforming, and a survivor of sexual assault, and that was a lot to deal with. And so Jamie is, in some ways, very much modeled after me, and in a lot of ways, not at all. Like, I grew up in Michigan, in a very kind of conservative state. My parents were teachers, you know, they're not big. We didn't have a lot of money growing up. And so she's clearly not me in a lot of ways, but some of the characteristics of her experience
Follow
along.
And I think you can see that, you can feel that when you're reading the book, because you really do slip inside the characters' skins, I felt. I don't know if you've read the book Just Juliet. I've read that recently, and I felt that with that as well, and I thought it was a similar kind of paced novel, and just really allowing the characters to develop and the story to play out. So was that pacing a deliberate decision on your part?
No. So book one was very organic and happened very quickly. It was easy for me to write. I went back and revised it and added in some sections and took out others, of course, which you do in the revision process. But I didn't do a lot of revision on it. My wife is wonderful. She's a sounding board. And so with that novel in particular, so I tend to be a seat of the pants writer. I don't answer. I'm not as much of a plotter. I don't lay everything out in an outline ahead of time. I knew where I was starting and where I was ending with that novel, and I knew that it would take place over about a year. And so I would finish one chapter, and then I would sit down and, like, arm wrestle my wife to sit down and talk to me about what should happen next. And so I had the kind of the grand plot arc, but I wasn't sure, you know, where the little things were going to happen in between, and like, oh, well, when does the father die, and when does that, like, okay, then I need to go back and put in some foreshadowing here about that, and like, when is this going to happen, and so it was very much an organic growth, whereas the second book, Game Time, I struggled with that one, man, in terms of plotting. I threw out, like, entire chapters. There are things that changed from, I had a beta reader as well as my wife, and there were major things that changed over the course of probably two or three drafts of that, and that plotting felt less organic to me. It all takes place over 6 weeks, you know, but there was a reason for it. I needed to set up the third book, and that's I think if you write series, right? You've done the but they're different characters, or are they all the same characters?
I've written one series of all the same characters, and one that sort of introduced new ones every time. So yeah, I've done
which
both.
Which one did you find easier?
Probably the new characters every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think it's, I don't know. It's difficult to, you think, oh yeah, I've just done that book, and then you go to the next one and it's the same characters.
Right.
Yeah. So you've got to put them in. Yeah, it is more difficult, definitely.
And so I found, like, and my wife really got sick of this, me saying, Emma keeps hijacking the dang story. She just keeps wanting to do this thing, and I don't want that to happen yet. I'm not ready for them to kiss yet. Things like that.
Yeah.
So I ended up doing some pretty major revisions on that one, and it was more of a struggle, which is maybe why I set aside book three. I've got book three. It's different from the others. It's completely plotted. Again, it takes place over the course of a year, and, I mean, there's the World Cup, so you kind of know what's coming.
Yeah.
And
I think
so it's like,
I think, I was going to say, I think Jamie might have a miraculous recovery, but I don't know. I haven't read it.
I'm not going to go with miraculous because there is a year and a half to play with.
True.
But, you know, things do get better for Jamie. I will definitely say that because she's had a crappy luck here.
I'm all down for the hashtag Blakewell, so, you know, I'm...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome.
I want to see it trending on Twitter.
That was really fun to write social media stuff. I don't know, that was really fun to do. So
yeah, yeah.
And if you want more of that.
Okay, and if you want to know exactly what we're talking about, you're going to have to read the book. so you haven't written book three yet, but it's when's that going to happen?
I'd say it's like a third of the way done at this point. I've got lots of different scenes written for it. Okay. It's a matter of uniting them into a narrative whole. So I'm guessing I had hoped to get it out in the spring, and then I hope to get it out in the summer, and now. For writing reasons, I'm definitely getting it out this year. It's just a matter of when. I'm guessing October. Right now is when I'm guessing it'll be out. My mom has dementia, and I stopped working in January, and I moved my folks to where I am 2 years ago.
Okay.
And so it's been, since I stopped working in January, there's been a lot of family stuff to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been something I've been writing about a little bit, too. My mom is incredibly strong, and her mother lived in a nursing home with, I don't know if you call them nursing homes in the UK.
That's we do.
Where,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And her mom was, for 10 years, had Alzheimer's and didn't know anyone. And my mother is just very determined never to go down that route. And there are very few options. We live in a state that has a Death with Dignity Act, so...
Okay, yeah.
I think it's been called physician-assisted suicide in other places, but it's really for terminally ill people, and you have to have two doctors sign on, and you have to be dying within 6 months. And so for someone who has dementia, Alzheimer's in particular, it can go really quickly, but you can't get a terminal diagnosis, and you can't have access to that option.
No, it was brought up here. I don't know if you know the author Terry Pratchett.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Who wrote the Discworld series, and he got early onset dementia, and he went to Dignitas, which is a assisted suicide place in a Scandinavian country, maybe Denmark.
Right.
So because it's the law is there, it's legal. And so a lot of people in Europe go there, but he looked into it. I don't know if he has since died. I don't know what the circumstances were, but yeah, it's anyway, we are getting away from the book themes. But
oh, sorry.
It's,
yeah. So,
but
so
it's,
the point is, I'm writing about that journey with my mom, where she's considering options.
Okay.
So right. it's been very intense, and I haven't gotten a whole lot of book three Outside the Lines done yet. I mean, it's you know, obviously it's in the works, and
yeah.
To me, it feels like there's quite a bit done, but from the reader's perspective, there's still a lot to go.
Yeah, but we'll look forward to that, and it's in the works. And of course, you haven't just written about football. You've also done a book called Gay Pride and Prejudice, which I was very intrigued by, taking the Jane Austen classic and asking what might happen if Elizabeth Bennet had decided Mr. Darcy wasn't for her, and vice versa. So, what gave you the idea for this? Because this is very intriguing.
Honestly, it was Pride and Prejudice and Zombies came out, and I didn't read it, but I was horrified by the idea, and then one night I kind of woke up and thought, well, if he can rewrite Pride and Prejudice and put zombies and ninja warriors in it, why can't I make them queer? Because that's the story I've always wanted to read.
Right, yeah.
You know, Jane Austen is known as the mother of the romance novel, and... Pride and Prejudice is the kind of first best example. I mean, it's not the very first, but it's the best example of early romantic fiction.
Yep.
And I love that novel. She's by far my favorite writer. She's so incredibly witty and satirical, and it's so subtle, which I think you Brits are known for. We Americans are not known for our subtlety. My first daughter had been born. I hadn't written in a while, and I thought, hey, here's a chance to write the book I want to read and also to try my hand at self-publishing. Because I'm a techie, and the self-publishing industry in 2010, 2011 was just kind of coming out, gangbusters there, and I really wanted to try it. I wanted to see if I could hand code, if I could come up with a cover, if I could do all of those things. And so I did, it was like a project. I approached it as a project. Here's a book I want to read. If other people like it, great. But if not, oh well, I've got the book I want to read.
Yeah. And but I suspect a lot of people did want to read it.
Apparently, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been interesting because it's probably been my best-selling, that's not true. Girls of Summer series has been best-selling series, or the best-selling books that I've put out myself. But Gay Pride and Prejudice has sold longer and better, I think, you know, over the long term than anything else
that I've done. Well, it's definitely...
And it kind of rises and falls with it. It comes back and people are, like, tweeting about it and talking about it, and then it goes away and then it comes back, so...
Yeah. Well, I think that title is just... That's a great title, isn't it? So it does what it says on the tin. And I'm intrigued enough. It's on my download list now. So, you know, you got another sale coming up.
Well, and it's mostly Jane Austen's words. And I added very few scenes because, I'm sorry, there's a lot of queer subtext in there. Charlotte, in particular, Lizzie's best friend, is all about the I hate marriage, I don't want to marry a man. But, oh well, that's the world that we live in, so I'm gonna.
Right.
I don't think I changed any of her dialogue.
Okay.
I may have added, in fact I did, I added quite a bit, but her existing dialogue didn't have to shift at all. Mr. Bennett was already really, fairly misogynistic, so maybe not as overtly as I make him, but he always kind of appeared that way to me in terms of his, sarcasm directed towards his wife in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And the way he kind of privileged Lizzie as the smartest and best of his daughters, and she's the least traditionally feminine in her approach to the world. So it was really easy to... I didn't actually plot any of it. I literally downloaded the text from Gutenberg, put it into Word documents, and just started writing. And I approached it as like a long revision. So hey, somebody wrote this novel, I'm just going to revise it now. And so...
Right.
It has those attendant things where you add, you remove, you shift, change things.
So did it take you a long time to do it?
Like 6 weeks.
All right, so pretty quick, yeah.
Yeah, because it's revision. It's not. I didn't write anything new. I didn't come up with any new characters. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't invent anything.
Yeah,
I guess one original character, but he's so peripheral and he shows up in, I don't know, one or two scenes.
Right. And so you can do this because the copyright is out of date now, right? I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Anything published, I think it's after 1929 or something, the estate of the people would have had to renew their copyright. And so there's so many things that are... and Gutenberg.org is a really good place to go to find out if something is in the public domain or not.
Hmm. Yeah. No, it was a really interesting idea, though, so I look forward to reading it. And you've also had a historical fiction hit with a book you wrote called In the Company of Women, which is... a tale of women joining the military in World War II and finding love there. How did that one come about? Did that take a lot of research?
It did. When I was in college, I was a women's studies major with a minor in history, so it was basically women's history. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated because I was in a American women's history course, and this other student raised her hand and said, "Have you considered this book?" And it was... And now, of course, I'm going to blank on the title. Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers.
Okay.
And it's a history of American 20th century, the 20th century in America. It's a lesbian history.
Okay.
And, of course, now I'm blanking on the writer. Federman. Lillian Federman, I think is her name.
Okay.
I can't believe I'm blanking on all that. That's funny. I blame my children for all of my memory losses. But anyway, so she's a pretty famous... historian. She's done a bunch on UK stuff as well. And so I picked up that book and read it, and there's this whole chapter about the Women's Army Corps in particular. And so that was my sophomore year of college, and when it came time my junior year to think about writing an honors thesis, not, I think maybe 10 people in our department each year wrote one, but my girlfriend at the time was writing one, or she thought she was going to, in the philosophy department, and so she talked me into coming up with an idea for the Women's Studies Department, and so I proposed writing about the Women's Army Corps. And we had in our archives, Smith is a pretty old college for America.
Mm-hmm.
and it's a women's college, and so it has this pretty well-known women's history archives, and we had the papers of one alum who had served in New Guinea in the Women's Army Corps, and one woman who had donated her, she basically, after she served, she wrote a memoir called As You Like It, and it was about being a captain in the Women's Army Corps. And so I studied both the autobiography and then the letters and journal entries of the other woman, the Smith alum who had served in the 40s. And that was just really fun. And I got to write 120 pages of dry historical analysis. And at the end of it, I thought, I just wrote 120 pages of dry history. I really want to just tell a story. I just want to write a story. So that's the idea germinated from there. And I wrote a rough draft of it probably in the late 90s. And then I kind of sent it out to a couple places and they were like, yeah, no. So clearly it needed a lot of work. So I set it aside for a while. And when I came back to it in the 2000s, the 2012-ish, 2011, I came back to it. And by then, there had been this wonderful explosion of self-published works. And so there were memoirs that I could get onto Amazon and I could find, you know, 12 or 15 memoirs by women who had served in America. And their varied experiences, there were their letters, they had their diaries that they were writing from. There was just so much more raw material to mm-hmm. draw from. And also, there had been a number of different nonfiction titles as well, written about the experience and what it meant to gender politics in America, and to the history of the gay and lesbian movement, which is, it's really fascinating. There's this kind of theory that the American LGBT movement for political rights wouldn't be the same without World War II, because during World War II, all of these young people came from mostly rural America and joined the military service, and they went all over the world, and they met lots of queer people in their units, in clubs, in cities where they were stationed, and then at the end of the war, they had to make the decision, and this is mostly men, but also quite a few lesbians. Am I going to go back? Because at that time, America was more rural than urban. Am I going to go home to my small town or my small city and marry someone of the opposite sex and mm-hmm. live a lie? And a lot of them said, hell no. And they settled in the cities that were the main cities where people were mustered out of the military were New York, San Francisco, LA. And those are the hugest queer communities in America for a reason. Very good reason.
I didn't know that. So there's another book that you can mm-hmm. write.
Yeah, well, and I think I talk about that in the afterword, maybe.
Okay.
But there's already a book out there written by... Okay, it's in the... See, I haven't thought about this in, like, a year, sorry. What's his name? Ellen... it's called Coming Out Under Fire, and there's actually a very good movie.
Okay. Coming Out Under Fire.
Coming Out Under Fire.
Okay.
Yeah, so look up on Amazon. It's a fantastic book that just... encapsulates this entire story. Cool. And he found these papers, diaries, and letters of service men and women that had been thrown out, and discovered this treasure trove of historical data that had the queer experience of World War II. And he went, oh my gosh. And so he's a social historian, a non-trained, just average citizen who said, I'm gonna find out about this history. I'm gonna do all this research. And it's this just amazing book and film that they made afterwards as well.
Oh, cool.
Coming Out on Fire. If you're interested in that, check it out.
I will look it up. Yeah, definitely. And that book won a Goldie as well. So so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that was really exciting. Didn't know that was going to happen.
Yeah. And do you keep that Goldie in your writing? Did you say you've got a writing shed or writing cave?
A studio.
Studio.
Yeah. Technically, it is a shed, but I put windows and a door in it, so now it's a studio.
I think studio sounds better, definitely.
It does, and I put drywall in and painted it a pretty color, and then I put in the cedar ceiling, so it's a very nice space. And yeah, I've got a bookshelf that I built the studio to, and so
you're like, very handy as well.
I like to think. What did I say to the Home Depot guy yesterday. I took a woodworking course after college, so I know just enough to be really dangerous. Yeah. So hopefully the studio has stood for several years, and hopefully the deck, when I replace it weekly, it'll still function as well.
So if you do all your writing in your studio, do you have a writing schedule, or is that just fitting it around your family?
You know, I do have a schedule. I used to write just at night when I had a full-time job, and that was exhausting. I was getting to the point where when I finished Game Time, book two of The Girls of Summer, I was exhausted. It was November by the time I was done with all the publishing and everything. And I took November and December off, and I didn't write at all because I was so tired from going to work all day, coming home, hanging out with my family, and then at 9 o'clock after the kids were well asleep, going out to my studio and staying out until 12 or 1. And it was a very difficult schedule. Part of the reason I stopped working was that my health was suffering. I wasn't getting enough sleep. I was getting headaches and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I talked to my wife, and we saved a year's worth of salary, and I did a little bit more self-publishing and less traditional publishing, because you can make more money with self-publishing, as you know, I'm sure.
I do know this, yes.
We get to keep a lot more of our profits. But I also have a good relationship with Bella Books, who's been a wonderful supporter of me, and they published in The Company of Women and Beautiful Game and Leaving L.A., and Solstice, my very first novel. So I'm indebted to them for giving me a shot. So I try to partner with them, and I consider myself a hybrid author.
Okay, right, yeah.
Yeah, so I still take on projects with them, and yet I also self-publish, and I sell all my books through their website. So if you can, buy them from bellabooks.com.
Yeah, I sell all my books through bellabooks.com as well. So they've been a nice sort of new sort of space for me to sell my books over the past year. I didn't realize that everyone can do it. So
yeah, absolutely. You can get them as your distributor, and I know they enjoy doing that as well.
Yeah. Are you writing it during the day now a bit more?
So now I get up in the mornings, I hang out, we have breakfast, I go for a walk. Sometimes I bring one or more of the children on the walk with me and the dog, depending on if I'm going for a run or not. And then it's just this really kind of, like, when my daughter's in school, our oldest daughter was in kindergarten, I would walk her to the bus stop and then come home and walk the dog and then get writing. And sometimes now in the summer I hang out with them more, and I don't get to writing until 11 or 12. But I get in a good 5 or 6 hours of writing every single day. And unless I'm doing things to help my parents or medical things like that, and that has actually taken up a lot of my spring. But I think we're in a better place now with all of that.
Yeah. So. And what would you say is the best piece of writing advice you've ever been given?
Say that again?
What's the best piece of writing advice you've ever been given?
I read Ray Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing, and he says, just make sure you write every day, at least 1,000 words. And so for me, that's... And I think I also read from him, or maybe someone else, to just keep writing, just keep moving forward, and don't revise every day what you wrote the previous day, because if you go back and start to revise what you just wrote, you're never going to move forward.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
They're both good pieces of advice. I think I tend to write in spurts, so I'll write like every day for a month, and then I won't write for another month, for the next month, and I need to get more onto that one.
Oh, wow. I would forget everything. Do you finish an actual whole novel in a month?
Yeah, first draft.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, but only this year have I mastered the art of that. So, and I find it's better if you do that, because it's like you're really in it, in that sort of very concentrated period of time. So I'm just in one of those months now. So,
nice.
Yeah, so I've done 5,000 words today. So hooray!
Oh, that's fantastic. I have a day like that once every 4 weeks, probably. Yeah. Otherwise, I'm like, okay, there's 1,500, there's 2,000. Okay, that's good. That's good.
Yeah,
okay.
I mean, it doesn't happen every day, but, you know, it's one of those days, yeah. And what's
next? I love those days.
Yeah, it's a good day. So what's next for you? I know you were talking to me about you're going to be writing a memoir Is that the next thing, or he's going to stick with fiction for the next thing?
So I'm currently working on 4 projects.
Okay.
Which is psychotic of me and not very wise in terms of completion. But it's been kind of, I'm working on this thing about my mom and Alzheimer's and options at the end of life. And that's been really intense. I'm also working on a memoir, so it's sort of memoir. It's really memoir, yeah. Okay. I'm working on a memoir of the history of gay marriage in America through my own marriage. Chris and I lived in Massachusetts, which was the first state to legalize gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And we got engaged about 6 weeks after the first marriages took place. We'd been together 3 years at that point. 4 years at that point. Mm-hmm. And we got married a year later in Massachusetts. So we're like, I think, round about a couple number 7,000 in America to get married, legally married.
Okay.
Which is kind of cool for us.
Yeah.
Like a historical note. But also, then we moved to Washington, and Washington was the first state in the union to vote in gay marriage. So in Massachusetts, it was a court decision, and it was very widely contested by the population. In Washington, voters said, yes, we believe in gay marriage. So that was kind of cool. We've been living in these two areas where it's...
And you're the common denominator there, so it's clearly something to do with you.
Obviously. Yeah. Our friends in Michigan were like, hey, move here, move to Michigan. We're like, hell no, I lived there before, I'm not going back. No, I love Michigan, so it was a great place to grow up, but it's just a lot more conservative than the West Coast.
So. Yeah. So you're doing a couple of memoirs and then some fiction as well?
Yeah, so do you read or write fan fiction at all?
I don't, no, neither.
Yeah, so don't start. It's incredibly addictive. are you familiar with the show The 100?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
It was the big thing last year where they killed off the main lesbian character, and they did it in a horrible way. And so this whole conversation about lesbian representation in television and film in America kind of goes out of that. And I was really into this character. I've never connected with, I don't really watch TV much. I'd heard about it online, that there was this lesbian relationship and I should check it out. And so I kind of had checked it out on Tumblr and I was like, that's kind of cool. Maybe I'll start watching. And I kind of caught up. I binge watched all the previous season where the two women have their first kiss, and then of course it ends tragically, but then they bring them back together in the next season, and the show was doing very stereotypical queer baiting. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
So they were queer baiting the fans, and they let it slip that Lexa, this awesome lesbian character, was going to be in the season's finale. So everyone kind of breathed a sigh of relief and said, oh great, she's not going to get killed off. Because it's a show where, you know, lots of people die, and lesbians are always being killed off.
Yeah,
and 2016 was like a banner year for that. I think something like 17 out of 35 lesbian characters were killed in 1 year.
Right, yeah.
And Lexa was one of them, and it was done right after she had consummated, you know, had sex with Clark, and they killed her off because her father figure was pissed off that she was involved with Clark, and tried to kill Clark and instead shot Lexa and killed her. And it was this devastating thing for so many queer youth who I kind of started following Tumblr because I was writing from the perspective of teenagers in the Girls of Summer series and young people, and I felt like, okay, I'm like in my 40s, I need to definitely go online and try to understand where these people are coming from.
Yeah.
If I'm going to try to speak for them. Or from their perspective. And so it was, I mean, it was shocking. And so I kind of got hooked into this fandom scene and started reading a lot of fan fiction. And then I started watching Supergirl, which has a canon lesbian relationship between Supergirl's sister. And again, I don't really watch TV, but I started watching these things online after the kids were in bed. And I don't like watching anything that doesn't have lesbians in it. I hate that. I don't know why.
Well, right, that's... That's narrowing the pool.
It's so narrow. I mean, Grey's Anatomy, I watch.
The Good Fight? You've been watching The Good Fight?
I haven't.
Oh, you should watch The Good Fight. It's a spin-off of The Good Wife. and it's one of the main characters is a lesbian, and she's still alive right now after the first series. So yeah,
a good fight. Plus, it's got a good name.
Yeah.
So I started writing in December. I started writing a Supergirl fan fiction, and I don't know why, but it's like 170,000 words, and I'm very close to being done. So I'm gonna finish that, and what I'll probably do is take that and revise it and make it about original characters and use a lot of the same kind of scenes and things and put it out as a lesbian sci-fi novel.
Going back to where lesbian fiction began, really, or sort of the modern take on it with fan fiction, really.
Right.
Yeah.
So I've done the reverse journey that most writers have done, I think. I started out getting published and then went to fan fiction.
Yeah. That's all good.
When I was a kid, I was not only hooked on romance, I was also hooked on fantasy and sci-fi. So this has been really fun for me to kind of remember my early passionate roots in fiction. And I would love to do a series, like a sci-fi series. And
I'm sure the readers would love that as well, because I know that there's a very keen and very large readership for lesbian sci-fi and fantasy.
Is there really?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there is. So I know that I often get asked if I'm ever going to write that, and I'm never going to write that. So you should write it.
You're like, I love romance. That's it. That's all I'm ever going to write.
Yeah, really. I mean, I may sort of go more down the sort of just more dramatic fiction path, but sci-fi and fantasy for me are not anything that I like or love, so or watch or read. So yeah, but I know that it's a big genre and getting bigger. So yeah, definitely. So finally,
I love the like creativity you can do with it. I mean, you can create entire cultures that are pro women, pro lesbian, and that's kind of fun to play with from my perspective. Like, I love playing with that idea.
Yeah, no, definitely. Fletcher, do you know Fletcher Delancey? She was on.
Uh-huh.
She's been on this podcast, and she's written quite an epic sci-fi series, which gets a lot of love online.
Yeah, I think it's on my to-be-read list for sure.
Yeah. So, final question. If you could be the love child of any two writers, alive or dead, who would you choose and why?
It doesn't have to be, like, two straight people, does it?
No, it can be anybody you like.
It's, like, the brainchild, not the physical.
It's the brainchild, yeah.
I live with 4-year-olds and a 6-year-old, so I tend to go to that literal place. Sorry. Jane Austen, for sure, and then Virginia Woolf, because the combination of the romantic and the modernist, I think, would be really interesting.
Yeah.
And with Jane Austen, you have this, like, witty, sarcastic, confident voice, and with Virginia Woolf, you have this incredibly depressing, darker side. So I feel like they would balance each other really well.
Yeah, no, I agree. That would be a good matchup.
You would?
It'd be a good matchup.
Yeah. So, and I like to think when I write that I have both of those things, that I have optimism and happiness, but also the darker side of life, because obviously life is dark in a lot of ways, and I like to explore both. But I kind of insist on a happy ending because of politics and LGBT representation, and we get killed off, and we get, you know, made miserable so often in books and in film and television, that for me as a writer, a proud and out LGBT writer, like, I am going to make sure my people end up happy if at all possible, and it is possible because I'm the writer, ha.
And on that note, that's a great note to end it on. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today, Kate. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, thank you, Claire. I really appreciate you thinking of me. This is awesome.
Thank you so much.
That's the end of this Lesbian Book Club. So this is me, Claire Lydon, signing off. If you fancy dipping into any of my books, the London series, the All I Want series, Nothing to Lose, or The Long Weekend, you can find out more at www.clairelydon.co.uk, or just look me up on Amazon, Kobo, iTunes, Bella Books, or any of the other digital outlets. I'm also on Twitter at Claire Lydon. I'm on Facebook, claire.lydon, and I'm on Instagram at clairefic. Thanks to Denise at My Lesbian Radio for hosting and producing this podcast. It's much appreciated. And make sure you tune in to the Lesbian Lounge with Denise for the latest LGBT news, views, interviews and gossip, and also the wonderful Ragtime, the other podcast on the platform. Join me next time for more Hot Book Club action, where I'll be interviewing the latest hot breakout debut author, Emma Nichols. See you then.